this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots in Genealogy, and I'm here today with Laura Giammetta. So welcome, Laura. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Super excited.
Oh, good, good. I get excited every time I do this for some strange reason. I don't know why. I just enjoy it so much.
Because it's fun, so.
Yeah. So now, have all your grandparents come from Italy? Are they all Italian?
So my mother's side of the family is not Italian. She's German, Scotch, Irish. We're from the Midwest, so that's very, German is a very heavy ethnic group in the Midwest. I'm from the Chicago area. And my father's side of the family is almost all Italian with one stray German grandparent that he had. So, and they were predominantly half is Sicilian, and then one of his grandmothers was from the Rome area, which is kind of uncommon.
I was going to say that, you know, when I looked at the email that you sent, I said, oh, Rome, I don't get to talk to too many people from Rome.
Yeah, she was from Segni, Rome, which is part of the metropolitan city of Rome, but just outside, kind of in that very hilly, I don't want to call it mountainous area, because I actually live in the Rocky Mountains. Those are real mountains, but kind of that high hilly area outside of Rome.
You know, we've been to Rome twice. We went like almost 30 years ago now, and then we were there last year. It's not like too many cities you've ever been to before, you know? And even, you know, I've been to London and, you know, there's old and new, but Rome is just, you never know what you're going to find there.
Well, I guess that's why they call it the Eternal City, right? I mean, there's just, it's like every emotion and feeling wrapped up in one place. I think that's how Rome is. And you have all that deep history, not just when you're at the Colosseum, but the deep history is, it's everywhere. You know, it's SPQR stamped on the manhole covers.
Yeah.
You know, it is an eternal city. It's just such a magical place. And I feel that way about a lot of different places in Italy. But I have friends who just went over yesterday. I'm so jealous. I can't see straight because I tried to go over. But of course, I had plane tickets for the month after COVID started. So like so many others, I haven't been able to get over since. And so they said, well, we're going to be in Rome for 4 days. And I'm like, okay, that's maybe 3 days too short, but they're going to all so many other great places. You could spend so much time in Rome. So,
we were the same thing. We had tickets for April of 2020.
Mm-hmm. That was when I was supposed to go.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just, you know, we had to cancel it. And then we postponed twice after that. And then finally we got to go. An interesting story about Rome. You still had to get tested back then, right?
Yeah.
So we got tested before we left. My daughter's test was good for 72 hours, but ours was good for 48. And we were just on the edge of going to the Vatican because they said you had to have the test within 72 hours or something like that. And I said to my wife, I said, well, if we go and what if we test positive, then everything else is, you know, we're going to be just sitting in a hotel room in Rome for 2 weeks. And I said, you know what, let's just go. What's the worst that could happen? Well, we get there. They're not looking at anything. There's a million people walking through the place and nobody has a mask on. So, and none of us got COVID. So there you go.
I'm glad you took the risk. It was worth it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So now when did your grandparents, when did they come to America?
So early 1900s. So one of them came a couple years before 1900. So mostly early 1900s, they all came through Ellis, but relocated pretty quickly. I haven't found any real vital records in the New York area. So they came to the Chicago area, kind of lived in that little Sicily part of Chicago. You had a guest who talked about that a few weeks ago. I can't remember his name. And then relocated to a city just northwest of Chicago called Rockford. So in Illinois, there's a very, very large Sicilian community there. I don't know why that Roman branch kind of came there too. I've never been able to figure that out. And of course, everybody is gone. All the people who could tell me things have passed away. So, or that could tell me things now. They answered a lot of my questions before, but I have so many more questions now, of course. So I grew up in Rockford, Illinois, which again is just north, northwest of Chicago. So they all just stayed there. There's a big community there. And some of the family came to the United States, some of the second, third, fourth cousins, and I've connected with them. And they ended up in KC, Kansas City. So big community from my Gemetta side, which is from Campo Reale, just outside of Palermo. Big community of Campo Reale families in that Kansas City area. Weirdly. So
do you know why that they, you know, what industry they were in that they came and settled to Chicago? Is it just that, like a lot of people, there was just opportunity there and they went?
Yeah. So I think opportunity, one of the mysteries I've been trying to pick apart the last year or two, because you know how long these mysteries can last, right? One of the mysteries I've been trying to pick apart is that my great grandfather, who was a little bit of a drifter and maybe a grifter, who came from Campo Reale. He was the only son of an only son, surviving son. He had one brother, but had died in Sicily. He left when he was about 17. And on his Ellis Island paperwork, it does say, so I think he left maybe because of the war situation in Italy, but also he was born in 1893. So he left in that, you know, in the kind of that 1910. I'm not exactly sure why he left, but he was still pretty young. He was 17, 18. On his paperwork, it said that he was going to a brother in Chicago with an address in that little Sicily area. And the brother's name was Saverio. I have never found any records for a potential brother of his, born in Sicily, in the United States. So it could have been a lie. I mean, people gave a lot of generic addresses, or, you know, I've never found any information. And I'm combed newspapers. Gemetta wasn't a very common name. So there could still be like a phantom brother out there that we've just never found. But if he was there with his brother, quote unquote, he didn't stay there long, because he came to Rockford pretty shortly after that. And that's when he connected with my great grandmother, who was from the opposite side of Sicily. She was from the Catania area. So from a little town up by Mount Etna called Lingua Glossa. So they connected in Rockford, and they have a pretty interesting story too. But she had come over a few years before that.
Yeah. And somebody told me, I forget who it was, but somebody told me in an interview that they looked up this address and there were, like, you know, hundreds or thousands of people that gave that address where they came from Italy.
So I've tried to back into that same thing too. Like Mulberry Street in New York was another one. This one in Chicago that he wrote down was Oak Street, which has been changed. The name of that street has changed, but I have done a lot of like Google Maps searching, trying to figure out where did they live. And I saw other people who had put similar addresses, if not, and obviously the, you know, the people in Ellis Island didn't know all of the addresses, especially outside of New York, right? Even New York, they wouldn't have known all of the addresses.
Well, and also I think, you know, if they had, and one of these brokers, for lack of a better word, that brought them over, they just told them to, you know, whatever they told them, that's what they were going to do. So what did he do? You know, what kind of job that he had when he came?
Well, he wasn't like an artisan or anything like that. He was a laborer, is what they put on there. And so I think he did day work. Over the years, he never really had a consistent profession. So, but I have found newspaper articles about him getting arrested because of maybe running pool halls with women. There was some prohibition stuff. So I think he just kind of did what he could. He and my great grandmother divorced after only a few years. So, which was very uncommon, you know, for the time. I've never found really good records that he remarried. She remarried. But I never found good records that he remarried. But some memories that my father had, who unfortunately he died in 2011, but he had some very kind of dim memories from his own childhood that his grandfather, this man, his name is Antonino Gemetta, that he kind of would come back in and out of his grandmother's life they did have a son. That's my grandfather. That was my dad's dad. So, and they kind of got reconnected later on in the 60s, later on in my grandfather's life. But also all of the information my own dad had about his grandpa was, you know, that he was a lot of pool halls, something about pool halls, connected families. You know, he didn't run numbers or anything like that, but I'm sure he knew some of those families. There were some very, very prominent Cosa Nostra type of families in the Rockford area. And, you know, he did have a pool hall. It is true. I have found some of the newspaper articles. So, you know, maybe he got involved with some of those guys and got beat up a couple times. I don't know. That does sound too, like it would align with all of the information I had about him. But again, I don't know all the stories, right? And so, and my dad didn't know all the stories. And his dad died at 65 too, when he was only 65. So that line is kind of a mystery to me, unfortunately.
Yeah. And you know, I just wish that I had asked more questions when I was younger. You know, my grandparents were, you know, both my mother and father were at the end of the family. You know, they were
okay
20 years younger than their oldest brothers and sisters. So, you know, my grandparents were older, but to your point about knowing some connected families, I know some connected families from New York. And
oh yeah, New York, of course.
You know, the funniest one was, it was my he was my my uncle's wife's cousin, and behind what's now Citi Field, used to be Shea Stadium, there were these junkyards, and you know, he owned one of the junkyards, and you know, I was young and it never really connected to me, because he was always impeccably dressed and manicured fingernails and all of this stuff, and had a brand new Cadillac every year. And it never really dawned on me until one day, I must have been about 15, and he said that they just got this new machine that crushes cars into a little square. And I was like, oh, crushes cars into a little square.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's funny because that, I mean, you just don't hear that stuff as much anymore, but we would be around town. Or I do remember one time when I was pretty young, I probably was 12 or 13. We went to just a racetrack to watch the horses run. And my dad pointed out there was a very old, elderly man there, and he recognized him because he was, I think he was Joe Zamuto, which was one of the prominent Rockford families. And so he would point out, well, my dad was born in 47. So Rockford was still, there was still an Italian section of town that his grandma still lived in, that he had been, you know, raised as a toddler and a young man in, until they moved to kind of the more growing part of the city. So, you know, if you were born in that generation, you might recognize some of those people. And while I think it got a little bit more underground as the 70s and 80s progressed in Rockford, or outside of Rockford, there was a big FBI thing that happened in the 80s, the mid 80s, I think, called the Pizza Connection, where they were funneling a lot of, I think, cocaine and heroin through pizza parlors. And so it's really, I don't know, it's fascinating history to me. And, you know, obviously I kind of missed a lot of that because I was a kid at that time. Yeah. So I was born in 75.
Yeah, well, my wife and I and my brother-in-law and sister, we were in a restaurant in Howard Beach in Queens, mm-hmm. and we had already gotten our meal, and the owner came over and said, "Those gentlemen over there wanted to know if you wouldn't mind moving your table, and they'll pay for your meal." So we looked over and we went, we don't have a problem. So I have to ask you, because I know Chicago pretty well, because I used to go there a lot. I used to work for Chase. I used to go there a lot.
Oh,
so
yeah.
where is the Sicilian section in Chicago?
Oh, man. So in the early 1900s, there was a section of these like five streets, a very small section. I'd have to look at a map because I didn't grow up in that area, called Little Sicily. And it's where a lot of the families, I'm here on my computer so I can look it up, but it's where a lot of those families settled and started. They don't live there now. It is in that area for people from the Chicagoland area, they'll know about Cabrini Green. So they did end up building some housing projects that have since been torn down now. I think Cabrini Green got torn down maybe a decade ago, but it's in that Cabrini Green section of Chicago. And of course, so it's west of the Loop and a little bit north, so not far from that Goose Island area. I don't know how
Okay.
well you
Yeah,
know
no, I know
Chicago.
Chicago pretty well, yeah.
Yeah, so it was in that area. It's not, of course, the Italians, because they came earlier than some of the other groups who have kind of settled in some of those areas, like Ukrainian Village and stuff like that. Now, the Italians ended up moving out to the suburbs, and I don't know. I mean, there were a lot of Italians in Rockford as well. I assume that they had at one point maybe lived in Chicago as well, but Rockford, the city I actually that I grew up in, was kind of evenly split, or it felt like it was kind of evenly split, Italians, Swedes, and Germans, which is a very common, Midwestern city ethnic, kind of landscape for when I grew up. It's changed a little bit too, but a lot of Swedes and Germans in Rockford as well.
Well, and, in New York, everybody knows Little Italy, and that's where the
Right.
feast is and all of that kind of stuff. But people that aren't from New York, I don't think realize that there were, oh boy, at least 20 Italian neighborhoods, if not more,
Probably,
throughout
yeah.
New York City, and some in Queens and some in Brooklyn and some in the Bronx, and again, they similar. They all gravitated from the, mostly from the towns that they came from.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com.
I was just going to say, I've done some client research in New York City, and it's real hit or miss, but if you get a hit, like if you find the neighborhood they lived in, and then you can find the church, and maybe you can access the church records. The city records can be great too in New York. Then you can get really lucky. It could be a treasure trove. But if you can't find the neighborhood, and then it's hard to locate, or they moved around a lot, then it's hard to locate the parish, which is usually where the gold mine is.
Well, yeah, and now it's Corona, Queens, where my mother and father, basically grew up. It's now mostly, mostly Mexican. The church is still there and all of that. But in the 50s and 60s,
Oh yeah.
you'll be hard pressed n to not find an Italian family. That's
Right.
how many Italians were in that area, and every store was owned by an Italian, and everybody was speaking Italian, and then, there were old ladies in black all over the place. It was just
Yeah,
so
my
typical.
dad said that was my his grandmother. So my great grandmother, who divorced my grandfather, she lost three husbands. She was married five times. It's a really long story, but she lost three husbands over the course of her life. And so I don't know if she just went into perpetual black, but my dad did say he had memories of going to her house on Sundays for dinner, dark curtains. She wore black. She never really learned English. I mean, we're talking in the 60s that she still didn't.
Yeah.
So, but you could get by in those days, right? Without And if you had been married to all Italian men who also were from Italy, and you stayed home a lot, you probably didn't need to learn English.
Yeah, no, exactly. My father's mother, my grandfather died just a couple of months after I was born in 1951. And my father's mother wore black until she passed away. That was it.
It's
My
so
mother's
interesting.
mother, she wore black for 3 days, and then she went back to the, flowered Vestalia, and that was it. And the woman used to say to her, "You're not wearing a black," and she's like,
Yeah.
it didn't, it just wasn't her, I guess,
Right.
And she was definitely the anti-stereotypical Italian
Right.
grandmother
There you
for
go.
sure.
Yeah, because it's very old country, right? I mean, it's very
Yeah,
old
yeah.
country. So.
But yeah, and I've talked about this before. Back then, we used to, I don't know if you remember them, we used to have the 3 day, all day funerals.
Oh, well, yeah. So interestingly, I mean, I am so grateful to my own father for doing something. He didn't know how to do any research, of course, and in early days, and I can tell you kind of about how I started, but everything was on microfilm. That was not something that he could kind of get into. We didn't live close to places where you could access any of those records. You're talking like the 70s, the 80s, even into the 90s. But he did a audio cassette recording with his father about, like, tell me about your life. And for many years, it had been misplaced. Like, I didn't know where it was, but I found it in a box like 6 or 7 years ago. But then, of course, I didn't have a way to listen to it because I didn't have a cassette player. I found a guy at work who converted it to an MP3. And so I transcribed it, but listened to it. And when my grandfather was very young, he was only five, he had a little sister who was two and had gotten hit by a car. Now, we knew this story. I had also found, you know, in the some years since some newspapers had been digitized, I found some articles about it. But he talked about, like, what it was like to have a little sister who went through this. And he said, I still remember, it's probably my earliest memory, I remember people coming to our house where they laid the body out for like 2 days, for the 2 or 3 day wake. And everybody was crying, and all they did was cry and drinking wine, but lots of crying. Like, he was so young, but this is what he remembered, right? I didn't know that they laid bodies out at the house. You know, I didn't know that was a tradition, because by the time anyone in my life died, it was, you know, 1989, and you went to the funeral home, right? And so, but it was such an interesting tradition to learn more about, and just to think about what it must have been like for my great grandmother to have a 2-year-old daughter who got hit by a car, so a violent and sudden death, and then to live through 3 days of an in-home, like, grieving process. It must have been so, so difficult for her. Or I think about what that was like for her, because it would be really hard to lay out your toddler daughter in your own home and have all these people coming in. Just a dark, just difficult grieving process that they participated in. So I don't know. I always think about that. It makes me a little sad for them. And also it gives me a lot more appreciation for how strong she was, or how strong a lot of those people were who experienced so much hardship.
Yeah. Well, my cousin, my mother's oldest brother was born in Italy, and he stayed there until he was married and had children and all that. But my cousin was smart enough to do the same thing. He interviewed him in Barese. And when I found out about it, I said, Joey, you know, you have to translate this thing. And he said the same thing. It's on tape. I don't know when I'm going to find the tape to play it. But he eventually did, and he summarized it. And it's a fantastic piece of history, because he talks about, you know, being in Italy and with his grandparents, and he never met his brothers and sisters until,
because they were born here.
They were all born here. So he didn't meet them until he was something like 35 years old or something, maybe even almost close to 40. And he hadn't seen his parents in that amount of time.
Was he raised by grandparents, or
he was raised by his
uncle?
He was raised by his grandparents.
Okay.
And they lived, apparently they lived pretty long, because my cousin, my oldest cousin, she remembers her great grandfather, or great grandfather.
Okay.
So she was born, I guess about 31 or something, 1931 or something like that. So he was still alive back then, you know, my great grandfather. And they lived in a house. They lived in the same house that my grandmother lived in.
Of course.
And my great grandparents eventually left the house to my uncle. The house is still there. We're going in September to see it.
Oh, cool.
I can't wait.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
And, you know, she described the house saying it was two rooms. She said there was a bedroom for my parents and the oldest baby, or the youngest baby. And she said there was always a baby. And the other room was the everything else room. It was the kitchen. It was the family room. It was the kids' bedroom, everything else.
Yep. That's amazing. That'll be great to go and connect with that, like something you can touch, that piece of history. But the thing I love about those recordings is I remember my grandfather's voice. I was 14 when he died, but I have a the span of our kids and our family are I have a youngest sister who's almost 9 years younger than I am. She didn't remember his voice. And I saw it because I sent it to my siblings recently. I sent them some snippets and she it didn't occur to me that she wouldn't have remembered what our grandfather sounded like because she was only six when he died. So that is just like a really precious, precious thing to have. And I wish I had it for all of my, on my mom's side too. I wish I had something like that because those stories, they are fascinating. I mean, what was it like for your grandfather or his brother? I can't remember which one you said, but to be raised apart from his whole family on a different continent and then to meet them all when he's in his middle age, that must have been crazy for him, So I love those memories. The pictures are awesome too. And guess what? Like I work at FamilySearch, and so we're getting exposed to a lot of brand new technologies that are coming. I'm just waiting for in maybe 1 to 3 years when I can feed that MP3 of him talking to my dad into a learning system, and then it can spit out like a moving picture with his voice, saying things using AI generators. It could do that now. If we found the right AI generators, it's really exciting. And that will be able to bring him to life a little bit for my own kids. So kind of like the old VHS tapes of when I was a kid, that they took of Christmas or whatever, they can see me. They'll be able to hear his voice and kind of imagine, or my own dad, what he was like.
So I didn't realize you worked for FamilySearch. MyHeritage does something very similar to that.
Oh yeah.
Only it's not their voice. It's not their real voice.
Yes,
It's
exactly.
a
They did something with a famous movie star named Val Kilmer. He had cancer and he's lost part of his ability to speak. So they some audio visual a company spliced together tons of his movies into a what's like a learning bank, and they learned the computer learned his voice, and then they could speak his voice with new video. It's really, really fascinating. FamilySearch isn't doing those kinds of technologies, but because we're in that same genealogy space, we get to see what a lot of our industry friends are doing, or people like Ancestry. MyHeritage has amazing photo tools that they've been developing that are just fascinating and a little bit creepy because you see it and you're like, just, but even I use the colorization tool all the time. And it really does bring the pictures to life, even if they're not moving. The
Well,
colorization tools.
the craziest thing they do now is you could send them, 10 or more pictures of yourself in various poses, and then they put you back into. And if you look at
Yeah.
my Facebook picture, I have me and my wife as, nobility.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah,
I
that's
did
what it is.
wonder. I wondered. I'm like, oh, is that one of his distant relatives? No, it's
No,
you.
it's me. It's
Okay.
me and my wife.
That's how good it was. I didn't even realize it was you.
Yeah, I do have one of my ninth great grandfather, the Prince of Avellino, and we're roughly the same age in the painting that they have of him and the photo of me, and there's similarities. I mean, shape of the face and the eyelashes and things like that. And I know I look like him because my wife said, "Oh my God, you look like him," and she would have been the first one to tell me. You're crazy,
Well, maybe when you go back, you're going to be claiming some royal
I
land you didn't
wish.
know
Yeah, we've been back to that side in last year, and no such luck. Although they
Ah,
did treat me
darn.
like a prince, so
Good, good,
I
good.
actually got to sit in his chair in the church.
Ooh, nice.
We went into the Duomo in Avellino, and they were telling us about the church and everything, and there were three chairs set up behind the altar, and they said those are the chairs that the priests use when mass is going, or the bishop uses when mass is going on. But that was the chair from the 1600s that your ancestors sat in. So the person Letizia from Italy, rooting, who set the whole thing up for us, she says, "Can Bob sit in the chair?" "Yeah, sure, I sit in the chair."
Well, hey, if you pay enough indulgences in the 1600s, you can get your own chair right next to the priest. I love it.
So
That's
that was
awesome.
really cool. So now we're on the topic. Have you been back to the hometowns in Italy, or you it was
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, so I started doing research, in the basement of the Family History Library in Salt Lake City, as it was called back, let's see, in the early 2000s. And I didn't know what I was doing. I knew nothing. I looked in the catalog. I don't know why, but there's microfilm for all three of my ancestral towns, which are in totally different places, and church records too. And so I didn't even know like what a treasure trove that was. If you've done research in different parts of Italy, and I've done a lot of research now for a lot of different people, there's some places that have nothing, or some places where, the church is burned down, or it's just very poorly organized. And so I found some microfilm, and I just started at night looking at microfilm, the way that so many of us kind of started this journey. And I would send pictures. I had a digital camera. I would send pictures to my dad through email. Look at what I found. Okay, I think that this document says this. So many of us, we figured it out on our own, right? We're self-taught. And I do speak Spanish, so I was able to kind of pick apart many of the things that were in the documents. And I had some very early successes that led me to say, like 2 years later, I'm going to go to Italy and find records there, not even realizing I had so much more in the United States that I could still look at. And so I took a research trip. I had been over to Italy with my grandma, just like a tourist thing, in 1999. And then if so a few years later, I went on a research trip, and I had this picture behind me. This is a picture I took of Campo Reale, which took me so long to get to. By the time I got there, all I had time to do was take that picture and then get back on the bus. Like, I do it so differently now. But I got smarter by the end of that trip, because I did end up in that town, Segni, outside of Rome. And there's all these tiny little archives. The city archives are like, oh, we'll look for this record and come back in 6 weeks. And that's not at the Comune. That's not helpful. But I had a very interesting experience in this town where I had found a monastery up kind of in the mountains. And there was a across the way, there was an archive there. It was a church archive. There no contact information or anything. And of course, it was closed. Well, I went to mass that afternoon to talk to the priest, Don Bruno, and he pulled me into the back office, and I didn't speak any Italian. He didn't speak any English. So we kind of figured it out, but he was very curious. Why are you traveling alone? Do you have brothers and sisters? Why are you looking for information about your family? Then he said, hold on a second. And he called this family. I gave him, like, I showed him a tree, and it had all these surnames on it. And he called this older couple, and he talked to them. He's like, and then he communicated to me, I'm going to send you over to their house. This They have the same last name as one of these names on here. And so it was like 8:30 at night by this time. I went to their house. They got dressed again, probably. They were an older couple. They invited me in. He was wearing his smoking jacket, and she invited me in. Here, have some hard candy. And I put out the diagrams, and I'm pretty sure we had a common, hers great grandparent, mine second great grandparent. She was very skeptical, though. She didn't quite, believe it. And she said, oh, well, my son, Vincenzo, he's the archivist at the archive across from the monastery. I'm like, what? So she called him, and he came over and met me. And then he took me over to the archive the next day and opened it up for me. And we were there for like 2 or 3 hours. He let me do some photocopies. And the archive was only open for like 2 hours on Tuesday afternoon. But and this was the last day I was there too. So it was a complete like surprise to find that. And I don't know, maybe that was the hand of God in my research. I don't know.
Oh, no, absolutely. I
I
say
believe
this
in
all the time.
this.
There's no accidents.
No.
These things happen for a reason.
Yeah. I think these people want to be found and remembered
Absolutely.
too.
I say it all the time.
And if I went back, I would probably try to get into that archive. I've been back to Italy on some work trips since, and some other, things, but I need to go back and do another research trip, which is what I was supposed to do in April of 2020, because I need to get back into that archive. There were so many beautiful books. Nothing's been filmed in there yet. I've been involved with where cameras are filming a lot of records from Family Search, but for the last 10 years, the primary emphasis for most of the cameras has been in state archives. And that's where because we're in a partnership with the Italian Ministry of Culture. That's where the Antenati, all mm-hmm. those Antenati records are coming from, Family Search microfilm, and then new capture that's being done all over the country. And we have captured some church records too, but that tiny little archive, I got to get back to that tiny little archive in Senying and get some time there. So, cause I actually have done so much more research now that I do need those end of line church records, not just for the tree that I've built up, but all the tree that's come across. So all the collateral lines that I work on.
Yeah. And, regularly. You know, I was surprised when I was doing my mom's family, because they're from two small towns in Puglia, Torito and Acquaviva della Fonte, and mm-hmm. Everything's there. You know, my dad's family, no, the Naples, you know, because there's, you know, how many millions of people from Naples and the surrounding area.
Yeah, Napoli research is so hard. Although there's tons of records, but it's hard because there's tons of records.
Because there's tons of records and they're not all indexed yet. We got to go into the state archives of Naples because of my Caracciolo connection. And we got a tour from the director, and they opened up rooms that they don't allow people in. And
I've done that in Palermo too. It's cool. It's really cool, isn't it?
Unbelievable, yeah. And they pulled out the oldest Caracciolo record that they had, I think, was from like 1100 or something like that.
And was it like a colored one that had gold gilding on it, or was
no,
it?
No, this was like a it was, if I remember correctly, it was something from, I think, the King of France recognizing the Caracciolo as the ambassador or something like that.
That
so it was
so
this,
cool.
You know, parchment type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then they have books with the family trees and hand-drawn family trees and things. But what struck me more than anything else, like, you know, in America, we used to, everybody's, they got white gloves on and they're going through it. Now he's just going through these pages.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the archivists are very particular, but also, but some of them aren't. But one thing I do think, I was on a business trip with our field negotiator when we went into the Palermo archive and looked at some of those. They're just so excited, though, to show people.
Yeah.
And they do have amazing records. I hope that they let you take pictures of some of those trees or anything like that that they were showing you.
Yeah, yeah. They let us take pictures or anything we wanted to.
Good.
You know, because of Letizia, she does this whole Italy rooting thing. You know, if anybody's listening and wants a really great tour of Italy, Italy rooting is the place to go to. But
I'm writing that down right now.
Because of my name, you know, my grandmother's Caracciolo and Piramalo connections, they just, you know, we could see and do and whatever we wanted. And then we had interviews with, you know, reporters and every place we went, and we were in the newspaper and all this kind of stuff. So what do you do for Family Search then? Because I've interviewed several people from there, Paul Nautor and a couple other
people. I know Paul,
people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Paul, and maybe you've talked to Suzanne Russo or
yes, yep, yeah.
Joelle Conte Joelle Cole.
I spoke to, the funniest thing about him is he's got this heavy Italian accent.
Oh, very. You wouldn't expect. Yes, very. So there's a whole team that works on the Italian records program. So we did sign a really critical and important contract with the Ministry of Culture about 12 years ago. And that was to take all of this film we had and digitize it. So for the state archive, all the state archives, the Tribunale or the Comune records go, the courthouse records go to the state archives after a period of time. But we had a lot of Tribunale film. And we didn't have as much Ravelli or the military records. And so we're capturing or have captured or digitized the microfilm records, all those Italian records that end up on the Antenati site. So my role, when I came to Family Search almost 9 years ago, I came to do the Italian records program, to be the program manager for that. And so until about two years ago, that was one of the things that I did. I'm not working as much with the Europe team anymore. Of course, I work with the records all the time as a researcher myself. And so so now I work on strategic programs and projects for Africa and the Middle East and Asia Pacific area. So I have a team of program managers who work with me on many of the activities that we did in Europe and the United States 20, 30 years ago, where we're just starting to, in some countries, just starting to gather genealogical records. So, and we have a huge Chinese project or program, really a multi-year Chinese initiative. Many of the records are very different in those countries because they have more lineage linked type of records and fewer civil records. And in Africa, we're doing something altogether different, which is collecting oral genealogies, because they'll have a tribal elder whose job it was to know like 14 generations of genealogy. And that becomes, it's really a tree, but it essentially becomes the record because they don't have any civil records. Or in Africa, this we've actually, I haven't, but many of our negotiators will go in and start talking to archivists, and they'll be like, well, the records we have are, they're in the back here in the shed, you know, next to some extra tires, and you know, so it's just a very different mentality in Africa. So the oral genealogies are breakthrough records for people of African descent, which that diaspora is really all over the world, but heavily concentrated in Latin America, the Caribbean islands, and North America. So those records are going to be breakthroughs. And you mentioned the Napoli records. So I was recently doing some research in Napoli. So at Roots Tech is a huge thing for the genealogical community. So the last several years, my job at Roots Tech has been doing Italian research consults. So I'll work with, you know, I worked in the library this year, but the last 2 years I did Italian research consults virtually because of COVID, with a lot of people in Latin America. A lot of Argentinians looking for dual citizenship, or a lot of Argentinians, actually. I did 22 in 2022. I did about 22 of these consults, maybe 24. And I think all but one were from Buenos Aires in Argentina. And their challenge is they don't have a really great Ellis Island record set. So their challenge is a lot of them don't know what their ancestral town is. And if you can find the ancestral town, a lot of them are in the more in the north than you know, the Sicilian or the Southern ancestors who came to America earlier in the 20th century. So some of those challenges are, they're struggling with a lot of those challenges, but I've been going through my own dual citizenship process. So at least I knew, you know, I know what to look for as I helped them. This year I worked in the library, in the Family Search Library downtown Salt Lake, and did an in-person consult. So anyway, what I was getting to is that one of the guys that I was working with, he was Napoli, and not around Napoli, Napoli, Napoli. And oh, it's so hard, because there's just so many records. And like you said, the indexing is still very patchy, but one of the great developments, and I don't know if Joelle or Paul or Suzanne had ever shared this with you when you spoke with them, was we are now starting to break into handwriting recognition indexes using the computer to create the indexes. So the 1950 U.S. Census was, there was a lot of handwriting recognition indexing that was done on that. And then the indexers who used to do indexing, just straight indexing, do a lot of like improvements, or what we refer to as curation. So the Italian records are going to go through these engines in the next, I don't want to be overly optimistic, but let's just say in the next 3 to 5 years, I see tens, if not hundreds of millions of indexes coming out of all of these images. And Antenati will receive those as well and be publishing those on their site as well. So the challenge, I think, for researchers then will become not like looking image by image by image, but you're dealing with all of these search results that you have to kind of comb through from the names. But that's going to be a power that, you know, the regular Italian researcher really has not had in the past. If you're a U.S. researcher, you've had a lot of that, or even a British or UK, you know, researcher, you've had a lot of index names to work with. But we're going to start seeing that. It's going to pop for all of us who do Italian genealogy. And it's going to be it's really exciting.
Wow, that's fantastic. No, and you know, they wouldn't have mentioned it because I interviewed them a few years ago.
Oh,
You know,
yeah.
all my Antonati records are written by people who write like me. I don't have the guys with the good
Oh,
penmanship.
yeah.
I've got the scratchy
When
guys.
I was recently, just last week, I was working on some records in Potenza, and the guy was a lefty, which is very, very uncommon, right? Because they would make
Yeah, make
people
it,
write with their right hand. And I could tell because he had the slant that he had to have been left-handed. And it was easier to read because I could tell he was very deliberate about the way he wrote. But yeah, they're all over the board. In my family's records, even in the same town, you'll see 2 years of really great handwriting in the comune, and then it's like total garbage. And the church records, for the most part, especially once you get back into the 17 and 1800s, they're just really challenging, right? So.
And you know, a lot of people don't realize, and even I put it on my site, on my Facebook page, that you guys do the free consultation and everything. And I had one done, and they unearthed, it wasn't the will necessarily. I think it was more the challenge to a will, from my fourth grade grandmother.
That is
She
so
her
cool.
husband was the Duke of Capricota. And she was from, I'm not going to remember the name, it started with a C. But there were no male heirs. And her uncle stipulated in the will that no one could inherit anything unless their last name was DeRiso. She was the only DeRiso left at the time. So by default, she got this, and what we found, I had it translated by someone. It was like 40 something pages. And when you get a will like that, you really get insight into the way the person thinks. And he had stipulated in this will that from his fortune, that the church had to get so much, you know, I don't know if it was 100 ducati, whatever it was, in perpetuity. And what happened was a male heir popped up after a while, and he challenged the will, and she actually, I believe, won the challenge. And her name was Maria Angela de Riso. She lived in Capricota, and she was exiled to France during the Napoleonic times, and basically lost everything.
Oh man, it's
And
amazing that
she
she
died in
got the
Paris.
inheritance, though. I mean, it's really amazing.
Yeah, and there was some law in Italy at the time. There was some
Always a
thing
war at
that
that
she,
time.
you know, she was entitled, and that's why he lost the challenge, because it was before a certain law and after, well, whatever it was. So she was exiled to France. She died in Paris. Her daughter, my third great grandmother, similar thing happened to her. She married Pio Mallo, and she had no th her brother had no male heirs, so she became very unusual. She became the Duchess of Capricota, we think what happened was, because when I look, if you look at the Libro d'Oro, you'll see the Piramalo family. And I was looking at this thing for, oh God, I don't know how long. And I'm saying, this has to be my grandmother's family. I know this is my grandmother's family, but she's not there, right? And my great grandfather's not there. My great great grandfather's not there. And I'm like, but I know this has to be the family, because there's only one Piramalo family. What happened was, the Duchess, her family name was Capici Picciello. When her son, the heir, inherited everything, he combined the family names to be Piramalo Capici Picciucelli, because the Capici family was more famous or more well known than the Piramalo. So he put all the three names together. His brothers and sisters did not get that name.
So they only have one of the
They only
names,
have the
or
Piramalo, right? And I finally, you know, figured this all out. And then when I finally met my cousin, you know, I met her online originally. when I finally met her, and I said, "Is this right? Is this the same?" She said, "Yes." And, you know, she didn't know why it was changed. But then we finally, through some documents she found and some other things, we kind of deduced it. The funny thing is, what she says is, the Capici Piccicelli had no money, but they had the name. The Piramalas had the money.
Right, right. Well, that must have been, when he combined the names, that must have been a real mouthful. Capici Piccicelli and Piramalo.
Yeah. If you look at the Libro di Oro, you'll find it Piramalo. It's a Piramalo with, I forget the word that they use, but then it becomes Piramalo Capici Piccicelli. So, you know, it was, you know, quite a find. And then the very first thing I put in was my great grandfather. And we have his card that my grandmother brought. I say it's his calling card. It's about the size of an index card. Uh-huh. And it has
like
a family
the one with
crest.
The picture. Oh, it has a crest on it.
Has a crest on it. And it says Piramalo Nicola from the Dukes of Capricotta. You know, they Duque de Capricotta. So my mother always told me that he was some sort of count to do whatever it was. When I first researched him, that was the very first thing I put in when researching my grandmother's family. And this record pops up in Caracciolo, showing Emilia Caracciolo marrying Nicola Piramalo in 1882. And the dates made sense. The names made sense. My father's name is Nicholas. My oldest aunt was Emilia. So all of that made sense. The dates made sense. But I had never heard that name, Caracciolo. So I called my cousin who lived with my grandmother. I said, "Did you ever hear the name Caracciolo?" And she says, "Sure, that's Nanny's mother's name." And she said, my grandmother used to tell them that her cousin was the princess, and they thought she was a batshit crazy old lady. But her cousin was the princess. was one of the princesses.
We had something really similar in our family too, because my dad, not with the princess thing, but my dad didn't really know anything about his grandfather's family. He just knew that he was from the Palermo area. And I had found an aunt of my father, probably a great aunt of my father, actually, Maria Cavallaro. She was so old when I started going down this path. I was, you know, this is probably a year after I started doing family history. And I don't know why, but she had just this razor sharp memory about her husband's family, which was this family, this Gemetta family. And she knew for some reason, you know, this would have been her husband's uncle's uncle's mother. So something like, anyway, something, some connection like that. She knew the name Carantola, like Carantola. And I said to my dad, "Does this name mean anything to you?" He's all, "I don't think so." But she knew that name. And so I started looking for Carantolas in this town. I'm looking in the indexes under C, right? Mm-hmm. Then I start seeing somebody marrying into a Tarantula line with a T, same name with a T. And I realized that Tarantolo line was the one that married Gemetta. And then my great grandfather became, you know, was Gemetta. And then I found that there's a large Tarantula exodus from Sicily that went to France too. And it might've been something similar. Might've been because of a war or a law or I don't know, but I found a bunch of those Tarantulas. That's where that Tarantula line ended up in Kansas City. So that's how I connected with them. And I connected with them through DNA. Which interestingly, so, and then I went to a family reunion out there in Kansas City with all these Tarantulas. They didn't know the name Gemetta, but all these Tarantulas in Kansas City, and I had printed huge charts for them so that they could see their ancestral group, because they didn't know a lot about the family trees either. So that was a really fun project to do. And then I've since started working on a whole family reconstitution project in that small town outside Palermo, just taking all the records and putting everything into huge spreadsheets and then just kind of reconstituting all the families and then attaching all the sources and the records and putting family search because that's where the tree is, where people can see everything. So,
yeah. Yeah. I interviewed this guy. The Next Generation is his software. He wrote it himself.
Yes, I listened to that.
Yeah,
I looked at that
he's,
software.
So I've started a site. I want to do the same thing with my mother's family from Torito.
I love those pages he
records out
created.
there. Yeah, isn't it really great what he
They're
did?
great.
What's really neat about it is you could start a website very cheaply and share it with people and put anything you want out there. I think he did an amazing job. It's my favorite site. But I'll give you one other quick Antonati story. When I was searching my second great grandmother, she was Swiss. And her name was Elisa Moher, Moher.
Okay.
And I found her and I found her family with three different names indexed. One is Moeller, one is Moore, and one is Moher, one is Mohr, and one is Moeller. But anyway, I figured it out. I found her and I found the records and everything. And I was like, all right, now I have this Swiss woman. I'm never going to get any, never going to go any place with this. And I tell this to people, just bang around out there on the internet. So I'm banging around out there one day and I'm looking for Italian military or something like that. And I find this book from 1853, I think it was, before the unification. And I find my second great grandfather, Filippo Caracciolo, and he was a lieutenant in the cavalry. And I look up the page and I find this Bernardo Moore, Moher, captain in the Swiss Guard. So now I'm thinking, well, Swiss Guard, I thought they protected the Pope. What is this guy doing in Naples? So now I have to go research this, right? So, the Swiss Guard were mercenaries, mainly from the Catholic cantons, Lucerne being one of them. And they would send these mercenaries to various, places in Europe, whether it's Germany, France, Italy, or Naples at the time. And I said, oh, okay, well, now I know her father. I'm never going to get any further than that. So now I'm out there banging around again. And I find this, I put in, Swiss ancestry or something. And I find the site and they say, if you have any questions about Swiss ancestry, write us in English, German, or Italian, and we'll answer you. So I send them a thing. This is the name. These are the two names.
Was this like the local archive or some government agency or?
It was, I don't think they're a government agency. I think they're just like, maybe one of these organizations that does research or has these records, whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So they said, oh yeah, we know the name. And they sent me a link to these handwritten trees that were probably put together in the 1800s, but go back to the 14 and 1300s. And it's all the prominent families from Lucerne. So now I was able to go back this Swiss family all the way back to like the 1300s.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And so, that's what I tell people. It's out there. The stuff is out there. You just have to be persistent. Sometimes you need to walk away for a while.
Well, it's true. It's true. And I think too, because a lot of technology is evolving, that's making things so much more accessible. So even people like your guest that you interviewed, right? Maybe 5 years ago, he didn't have those pages up. So you would have never found them in a web search, right? But if a comune puts up its own page, Agrigento, the diocese in Agrigento now has digitized a bunch of their church records.
Oh, really?
And that's a
my
really
wife's,
big...
my wife's family's from Shaka.
Oh, okay. So they might even be up there and now they're trying to index them, but those records were not previously available before the diocese and they're putting them up a little at a time. But if you just wait, between sometimes you have to noodle on things. That's one thing I've found. Like sometimes I had to noodle on a problem when I came back. I'm like, oh, now I understand the answer because I know more, or I just had a different piece of the puzzle, or I'm looking at it differently. But records are coming available all the time. So yeah, FamilySearch has tons. Ancestry, not so much, but they have a couple pockets. Antenati continues to publish. They kind of went on a publication pause during a lot of COVID, and they've been doing a lot of back publishing. Like millions and millions of images are coming online with Antenati over the last year since they started publishing again. And then the indexes are going to start popping, in the next several years. So yeah, sometimes you got to take a break. And if you have a couple different towns you work in or different line altogether, then you can kind of move over to that space. I've been focusing so much on my Palermo area. I've neglected my Catania and my Rome area, but there's just never enough time. That's the other thing,
No,
between
I know
raising a
that's
family and
true.
working and doing all your other things, there's just never enough time. So
As
I
my
could work
wife
on it
likes,
all day, because you start working and like 4 hours later, you're like, oh wow, where did the last 4 hours go?
to say, are you looking for dead people again? I'm like, yeah, I'm always looking for dead.
Always looking for
But
dead people.
as you said earlier, the dead people want to be found, and that's why I think that's why we're here doing this stuff.
Yeah, there's so many like great quotes about that. I can't give the exact quote, but there's a really great quote from Alex Haley, who wrote Roots. Anyone my age and older probably will remember that, but that he said something like that there's a hunger that's marrow deep to know, where you're from. And it does inform us, and I think it does help us understand little parts about who we are too. And I think also, so in 2017, I lost my husband. He was 44 at the time, and there was I never really felt a kinship to people in my family who had passed on the way I felt, for instance, to this great grandmother who lost three husbands through death. I felt a real kinship to her, because I thought, those people did really hard things too. And what was it like for her to live through that? Because now I'm living through a very similar experience. And wouldn't say that I felt her presence or felt her with me or anything, but it helped me to know that I wasn't the first person who had gone through, something so incredibly difficult at such a young age. She went through those things too, and still managed to raise a remarkable son who raised a remarkable son who became my father, right? And I'm raising now, hopefully, people who will turn into remarkable people. They're just still pretty little. I don't know what they're going to turn into yet,
Oh, I'm
but
sure they will. I'm sure
it's
they will.
inspire it inspires me. It inspires me.
That's true. It's you don't realize some of those things until you actually go through it. My sister lost her son when he was 10 years old to cancer, and she's still every single day. She's it's just children aren't supposed to go before the parents.
That's right. That's right.
So it's just one of those things. Well, this has been fascinating. I could keep going. I could go for hours and hours and hours, but we don't want to bore everybody to death. But I
Well, it was
appreciate you
great for
taking time.
us.
Yes, oh, it always is. I really appreciate it. So before we go, what give the people a few pointers on what to do with FamilySearch and how to use it.
So there are a lot of, especially church records that are available. Everything in the FamilySearch centers. If you can't access something at home, the FamilySearch centers have a lot of access. And the reason I'm in part of many Facebook Italian genealogy groups and dual citizenship groups, people do complain, and I totally understand. It is frustrating. The reason many records are accessed from home use are because of the contracts we have with the people who own, for lack of a better word, those records, whether it's the state archive or the tribunale, the courthouse, or the church, the parish that contract was signed with. All of the records that we gather are gathered through contracts. So those contracts all have stipulations based on the record custodians or whoever owns those records. And that's worldwide. But it can be frustrating when you're at home and you're like, why can't I just access this digitized record at home? I have to remind myself, we all started doing this with microfilm. Like the only place you could look at it, right, was the FamilySearch Center. And if you were lucky enough to live in Salt Lake City, you could go pretty much whenever you wanted. But if you were unlucky and lived in St. Louis, Missouri, or Wichita, or LA, your FamilySearch Center was only open a few hours a week. And that's still the case in many ways. But there are a lot more records available digitally. At home. Everybody knows the Antanati site has made a lot of changes, some good, some have been a little harder to navigate. You know, the big change that they made, but they continue to bring on tons and tons more records. The one thing I would really advise people to do, and this most recent round of consults I did at Roots Tech in person at the Family Search Center reminded me, very few people, researchers, even some experienced ones, know about some of the great records that are there, but a little bit harder to get through, like the Procicetti or the Allegati records. So those are they're like the marriage packets, marriage band records. If I can tap into a Procicetti or an Allegati packet, like for a friend I'm doing research for, or for a client or anyone else, that's a gold mine. Mm-hmm. You know, the earliest civil records can only take you back to 1806, and that's more in the South. And a lot of times they don't start till 1866. You know, if you get further up into the country, or some of the latecomers, shall we say, you know, some of the Comuni were a little bit late. And those are great. The civil registration I find them to be very comprehensive. They're very easy to read. And if you can get through the handwriting, a lot of times, especially once you get to the form-based publications. But if they have Allegati or Procicetti, you can sometimes get back. They would include random records in there. The bride or groom, their grandfather died, so they included the extract of the death record. Well, that could take you back 100 years that you didn't, and you know, two extra generations that you didn't know anything about before. And so that really is, when I started getting into those records, they are harder because a lot of them are handwritten. But they do include a lot of those extract records, and you don't need those for dual citizenship necessarily. But if you want to take your line back, you know, past the 1800 mark, shall we say, you probably need to get into those records, especially if there aren't church records. And of course, the church records are in Latin, so they're much harder for people to get through. So that's a great tip, you know, get into those Procicetti and those Allegati records, and a lot more military or the Revelio records are now coming online too. And while they don't have, you know, there weren't women except mothers, there weren't women in the military records, they are beautiful records. They've been recently filmed, so the film quality is very good, and they do have a lot of information on them. So that's another, you know, that's another great thing to get into if you feel like you've kind of exhausted your research, especially if you're just going vertically, like up your tree. You're going to stop somewhere. I do a lot of horizontal research and have connected with cousins through, now I recognize names that pop up in DNA results and stuff like that because of that, those collateral line research. And then always check your messages. Ancestry, Family Search, like people message me because of stuff that I put in that is their direct line, but is my indirect line. And I really do try to include is the sources that you know, sourcing is important. I mean, not to sound too academic, but it's how anybody can trust the conclusion that has been put in any tree, whether it's an ancestry tree or MyHeritage or Family Search. So I really try to be responsible and source as much as I can, even for my own line. Bob, have you ever put something in the tree, your tree, and then you came back to it 3 years later and you're like, wait, why did I make that conclusion? I'm not sure if that's right. And then if I didn't, like my earliest research is the worst, but now that I'm a better researcher, you know, I find that less, but I still will go back to some of the early things and I'm like, I don't know if that's true. And then I have to research. Oh, and the other thing, the research logs, someone gave me that tip early on in my process, and I am thankful every day for those research logs, because I would capture everything with the right surname in a town, and I didn't know how those people were connected. But eventually I got back further. Then I find, oh, a whole sibling group. Oh, I know about this guy. He married this person. And then I get a whole batch of children just off my research group. So I don't have to go re-research all those same films. And it is kind of genealogy 101, but I didn't think to do it until someone taught me. So that was a game changer in my research. So Procicetti and Allegati, don't be afraid. everybody, it's messy to get into. Everybody doesn't know how to do it when they first start it, right? But if you can get past the handwriting, those are a gold mine. Don't forget to source, your things in any tree, even just your own tree, so that for yourself. Because really, if I'm just sourcing for myself, then I don't have to re-research anything and just kind of keep track of what you're looking at. I do the same thing if I do research for a friend or a client. I write down everything I've looked at so I don't have to go back, but also so that they know what we've looked at. So in the
That's a good
future.
tip. Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. I mean, we went in a whole nother direction, so I had no idea you work for Family Search, so that's great.
It was fun.
And it's good for to give the people that advice. So thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bob.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Sorrentino, just letting you know that my new book, Farmers and Nobles, is now available for sale on www.italiangenealogy.blog/farmersandnobles, or you can find the link in the podcast notes. Thanks for listening.